Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I'm Rick. He is Dan. And Dan, this is the 52nd edition of this podcast, and that can only mean one thing.
Two.
That's right. It is the Two Holloway edition of the Dane and Victory podcast. And just for good measure, I've got my...
Just to be clear, they're not booing. They're saying Two, which is his nickname.
If you hear that... Just for good measure, I've got my Two Holloway bobblehead sitting right here as we do this podcast watching over us. So I feel like that's good. Two Holloway, obviously one of the greatest musketeers to come through. If we're talking about since I've been covering the team, he's probably the best. I kind of had that year of Jordan Crawford while I was just a measly photographer for Brian Snow. And that actually brought about my favorite Two Holloway moment. It was a press conference. I'm not going to do what you all think I'm going to do, though. If you go back a little bit before the one you all are thinking about, 2009, 2010, Xavier won that crosstown shootout 83-79 against UC that year. And I remember when Chris Mack came into the press conference, he was talking about how at the end of the game, Lance Stevenson had just been tearing it up for UC and Xavier was trying to find a way to stop him. And they had switched two on him. And one of the reporters asked Chris, why did you put two on Lance? And he said, well, they came into the huddle and two just goes, I got him. And Mack says, you got who? He goes, I got Lance. I'm from New York. And Chris was like, okay, I'm from Cincinnati. Go ahead and guard him, I guess. Like, just classic Two Holloway. Nothing ever made sense. He was the most different guy I think I've ever met. But I remember looking back on that game, just thinking that was kind of the one where we already knew he was going to be pretty good. But that game is what made me realize that Two Holloway was going to be really special as a player. And I'll never forget that quote as long as I live. Just him walking into a huddle and saying, I got Lance. I'm from New York. Like, that would make sense to somebody.
You know, the thing that I always think about with Two Holloway is there's always this debate about whether or not clutch exists in sports. You know, you hear it a lot in baseball. And my thing has always been that I'm not sure that clutch exists, but I know that choke exists. I know that because people do it in their daily lives. You have a job interview, something like that. You're not prepared and it goes poorly. A date, I guess. But Two Holloway was one of the few guys that I ever saw that actually was capable of not just performing to his par when the game was on the line, but actually exceeding it. And there's too many examples of it really to go through. But if you think about it, it started with virtually his first collegiate game.
Yep.
When Xavier played Missouri, a really good Missouri team, in the Puerto Rico tournament. That was the year that Dante hit the shot the next night to beat Virginia Tech. But Two went, I think, 10 for 10 from the foul line, including a lot of crucial foul shots down the stretch to win that game for the Musketeers. And then, of course, I mean, the idea of a freshman going to the line. Well, actually, I guess he was a sophomore the next year, going to the line with no time left in overtime of a Sweet 16 NCAA tournament game and knocking down three free throws to tie the game is something you'd see in a movie. So that actually, those three foul shots are the single memory that comes to mind. But yeah, I mean, there's a million games you can look at with Two. You know, he beat Dayton at UD Arena with a step back three. He had that unbelievable run against Purdue his senior year. There's just too many to count. Two Holloway, great Musketeer. I think he's the most clutch performer I've ever seen, even more so than a David West or a Romain Sato or even a Tyrone Hill or some of the other guys that have gone down that have their numbers hung up in the rafters at CentOS Center. I mean, Two just had that knack for coming through at the key moment.
Well, it's funny. I kind of like what you said there, because if there was ever a person that was going to make you believe in clutch as something that's real and that exists, Two might be the perfect candidate or perfect guy to do that, because you hit the nail on the head, I think, when you said there are a lot of people who can't perform to their level of par when they're in the big moment. They choke. but he consistently, I mean, how many times did people talk about how if he could just shoot the ball a little better, if he was a better 3-point shooter, but yet time and time again, when it mattered, we'd see him make big 3-point shots. I mean, he might be 0-for going into the last minute of the game, and then he'd hit 2 or 3 of them from beyond the, I mean, that he was absolutely someone who raised his level of performance. That was kind of an interesting point you brought up. Going, you know, kind of the thing I said was a little bit more too off the court and how he was just so different. Another moment that I'll never forget, and this is another thing where it's not like ha-ha funny. It was just so like, who is this guy when he would talk to you sometimes? I probably maybe had one or two normal conversations with Tu Holloway that I felt like both of us were conscious of what we were talking about. The rest of the time, I never felt like it was a normal conversation ever, or we were actually clicking when we were talking. I remember one day he came over. It was just me and Shannon Russell sitting courtside at practice, and he came over and just put his leg up on the scorer's table in front of us and started stretching just randomly and didn't say anything for a second. Then he looked over and he goes, "Shannon, you know why I have so much fun out here at practice every day?" She's like, "No, not really." Like, wondering where this is coming from. He's like, "Because afterward, I just go back to my dorm and watch ESPN and don't really do anything." And then silence for like 15 seconds. And both Shannon and I looked at each other and just looked back at him. And we're like, "Okay." And then he walked away. And that was, I mean, he was the most bizarre guy at times, but unbelievable competitor. All right. Well, we'll do the
two. One thing that I will say, I do want to say before we leave that subject is that, it's unfortunate that the brawl happened and some of the comments that were made afterwards happened, because I think that it really changed his career for the worse in the last half season that he was at Xavier. I think it soured people on him, which I don't think was entirely fair. And I think that if that hadn't happened, if Xavier had had a similar season to what they had, went to the Sweet 16, I think his number would have been retired. And I think it deserves some consideration maybe down the road once all of the lingering stuff from the brawl has gone, because he was just such an incredible player. And to my mind, I mean, if I was going to pick a point guard that's come through Xavier, he'd be number one for me. So that's all I wanted to say about Tu.
I'm with you
on Tu Holloway.
On the jersey being retired thing, I'm completely with you. I think that's a must in the future. Dan, we've had it's kind of a slow time right now. Not a ton going on when it comes to Xavier basketball. I mean, you're kind of in that spot where guys are off campus. They've gone back home for their quick little summer break that they get. The freshmen aren't in yet. They don't come in until the 22nd of June. So there's not a ton of news out there. We do have a few kind of newsy items to get to that we can hit on quickly and give our thoughts about. And the first and probably the biggest thing was the schedule, which we continue to fill out a little bit farther each time we come on a podcast, I think. And the additions, the big one was that there will be a home and home with Auburn starting at Auburn this season. Like Snow said on the message board, it's a good game, I guess. It's at least a power conference game, but it's not, definitely not a game that you point to and look at and say, "Oh, hey, we beat Auburn. Now, you know, we're getting in the tournament now." But it is a game on the road against a known power, a team from a power conference. It's a decent ad, I guess, when you look at all things considered.
Yeah. And of course, Bruce Pearl being the new coach at Auburn, they brought in a couple transfer players that are going to be immediately eligible. They added another kid today. And so it's possible that Auburn will go from being absolutely terrible to, you know, a mid-level SEC team. But when I look at this schedule, I mean, so far we know there we've got, I guess, four confirmed home games out of the seven. You have IUPUI, and I'll give the KenPom rankings. I just looked at the NCAA selection committee, and Ron Wellman has rotated off, so I'm going to worry about KenPom instead of RPI for the time being.
Yeah, don't look at IUPUI. That's not pretty.
IUPUI, 330. Ooh. Murray State, decent team, usually pretty good, 115 last year.
They don't. Florida I Gulf think they're going to be better, though. They don't really lose. Yeah, I know,
and just to be clear, these are last year's numbers, and there may be significant difference this year. Florida Gulf Coast, they had the cute story a couple years ago, 171 last year, and Alabama, 92. The last three games, two of them are going to be bye games. I would assume that those would be similar teams to the bye games Xavier had in last year, which included Miami, Morehead State, Evansville, Bowling Green, between 180 and 230 in the KenPom. And then there's going to be a bye game associated with the Wooden event, which is going to probably be a
250 plus
a giant weight on the RPI, probably 300 plus, similar to Abilene Christian last year. From the away games, you've got UC, who was 23rd in KenPom last year, but I think it's fair to say that UC's has suffered some personnel losses. There's going to be a lot of guys adjusting to new positions. I think that'll still be a solid game. I think they could be in the mix at the NCAA bubble.
Well, the thing they have working for them is that they're in that conference now, and it just, you know, it lost Louisville, so it's going to be a lot easier for them to win their conference and make their tournament that way and make a big run. But you're right, their team's not going to be nearly as good.
But they have scheduled aggressively in non-conference this year, which was not something they were known for in the past. True. I mean, so that's one thing. Auburn was 129 in KenPom last year. Mizzou was 78. I think Mizzou has lost some guys from last season. Had a coaching change, obviously. So you look there, and it's not a very daunting slate. It's not a slate with a lot of those high RPI type games. And then, you know, in previous years, Xavier has made up for maybe a weaker non-conference schedule with a good exempt event. But this year, I mean, I'm looking at the seven other teams in the Wooden. The best KenPom out of the seven was Washington at 95. Only one of the seven teams, Western Michigan, made the NCAA tournament. They actually had a pretty good RPI. They were 66 in the RPI. So there's no help really coming from that Wooden event. And so you add it all up and, you know, you look at last year where the strength of schedule was helped by having two games against a Tennessee team that was seven in the KenPom, 42nd in the RPI, made the Sweet 16. You had Iowa in the exempt event, 28. KenPom, RPI 56, made the NCAA tournament. You kind of lose those games that were really helping out the non-conference schedule. And now you look at this and, you know, Mario has said when we've had him on here that they make the non-conference schedule with the goal being to make the NCAA tournament to get the best possible seed. I'm concerned that this particular schedule as it stands right now, and it's not likely to get better, is something that may be so bad that it might actually negatively impact. I don't think it's as bad as SMU or Pitt or some of the teams that really got dinged on seeding last year because of their poor RPI or their poor non-conference RPI or their poor non-conference scheduling. And I think X will get some credit for having six road neutral games on this schedule compared to last year when they only had, I believe, four or five. But you look at these numbers and they're not pretty. And I understand that it's a young team that needs to that needs to get some experience, that needs to gain some confidence. But you kind of wish that there was at least one game, maybe a pie in the sky type neutral site game against a really good team that would at least boost this a little bit. Because as it stands right now, I mean, if some of these teams tank, it could be very difficult for Xavier to make up ground in the Big East schedule, given the number of 100 plus games that are on this schedule. I mean, that's when I look at this, that's what I see.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. What it all comes down to now at this point for Xavier, and this all goes, I don't want to get too much into the conference thing because Xavier's already in the Big East. There's no point in, you know, arguing about that again. But I had always said before that ever happened, when everyone wanted Xavier to get out of the A-10 so bad, it was always a be careful what you wish for scenario, because we saw exactly what UC did when they went to the Big East, especially with their scheduling. And what it comes down to is you have to win conference games now. You have to win in the Big East if you're going to make the NCAA tournament. That's the bottom line for Xavier. And you see with this schedule, they know they're going to lose games. So it's not a shock that they're scheduling a little lighter non-conference. This year, I think, is a little bit of I don't think it'll be this light every year. In other words, I think they will add that big neutral site game going forward. I think that will be something they really try to get. And I think they've added some flexibility by moving the Crosstown Shootout back to a home and home series, that they can do that a little bit easier. It just wasn't in the works for this year, I guess. But I think end of the day, it's going to come down to this team has to win in the Big East every year if they want a chance to make the tournament, because their non-conference schedule, if you make it super tough and you lose a couple of extra games, then you don't have that flexibility once you get to Big East play. And you're really going to be in a tight spot when you play three tough Big East schools back to back to back in a short week. And now you're kind of screwed that way. Or if you do it this way, where the non-conference schedule is a lot easier, but there's no big wins on it, well, then you have to win a whole lot more games in the Big East and you still don't have a lot of flexibility. It's going to be tough. And I don't think a lot of people looked at that when they talked about getting into a better conference. The one thing I do think, just take away the basketball side of things and whether or not Xavier can make the tournament, from a fan's perspective, I do think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out going over the next couple of years. Cause the one thing that Xavier has always kind of held in this city as, a way to kind of look down at UC, if nothing else, is fan attendance. They've been able to sell out basically since they've been at the Cintas Center. I wonder, does that change going forward? Because we saw at UC, especially when they quit scheduling those big non-conference games, they weren't selling out before that, but they went way down when it came to their non-conference attendance after that, because fans started figuring out, I can buy a Power Six Big East package or whatever and go to six great Big East games and skip all the ones against these crappy teams that you're bringing in to the Shoemaker Center. It's going to get to a similar place, I think, with Xavier if you don't schedule a couple of those big time teams and keep bringing in a good game at least or two into the CentOS Center each year. And it's kind of interesting. We saw another news item recently is that there's no ticket price increase this year at Xavier. In fact, some season packages have been decreased by $50 to $100.
Yeah. In fact, mine went down by $100, which was a nice surprise this summer. And it was already the best deal in Cincinnati sports before it went down. So thanks to XU for that. But I actually don't worry as much about a major decline in ticket sales because I think, first of all, the value for money is still there because of the excellent Big East slate. And I think you saw it last year with the level of attendance and intensity at those Big East games. People are really up for them. It's always going to be difficult, I think, for Xavier, for other college basketball teams to get big attendance at those early season bye games because they just don't move the needle for people. And it just is tough. People have different things going on in the fall, and the idea of going to see Xavier play IUPUI when your kid's high school is playing a game that night or a football game that night, or there's something, it's just not something that's going to mobilize large numbers of people to get down to CentOS Center. But I don't worry about it too much because I do think Xavier's marketing people and the people in the basketball department at CentOS Center, they understand, I think, the value proposition. And I think they're always thinking about that. And I think this schedule is going to be – it's going to be a bit of an aberration because next year you're going to have UC at home and you're going to have the beginning of the Big Ten Challenge. And so I think that you're going to see at least a couple more marquee names on the schedule. And, you know, they're being aggressive about selling season ticket packages. So I don't see the risk of a long-term drop in attendance, but I do think, you know, that they're not giving themselves – X is not giving themselves a whole lot of margin for error in this non-conference schedule because, I mean, even going – you know, UC is not until February. So you look at the 12 games before Big East conference play starts. I mean, you're worse than 10-2 against that schedule. That's not good. Right. I mean, they're really going to have to get the job done against these teams that don't really match up with them or ought not to on paper. You know, you can't have a slip up like a Wofford or even what could have happened last year with Bowling Green and Evansville. They're going to have to go out and get the job done every night. But moving on to, I think there are a couple other issues we wanted to deal with, Rick. First, one is that Justin Martin, it's confirmed, will be leaving Xavier for SMU. When you look at Justin Martin's career at Xavier, the 3 years he was here, Rick, I mean, what's your assessment? And I'll ask you the harder question. Do you think that it's addition by subtraction for this year's team that Justin has decided to go elsewhere and kind of open the way for this talented freshman class?
Well, as to the latter part of your question, I would just say the coaching staff made this decision with Justin. Let's put it that way. It wasn't just Justin saying he wanted to leave. This was kind of about as mutual of a split as I think you can get in one of these situations. I know people would deny that type of thing, but I do think, look, it wasn't like Xavier was just going to say, no, we need one of our best returning players to get the hell out. Like, they were obviously giving him chances, wanted him to stay, but things weren't working out there. We don't have to rehash all that. So I do think if the coaching staff was okay with him leaving, I mean, just think about that. It was a senior with experience who turned into one of your leading scorers and better defenders at the end of the year. If you're in any way, shape, or form okay and telling this guy you'll help him find a place to move on to, then you have to think there was some, that this was addition by subtraction, that they were concerned about the impact he would have on the younger guys that he would be around. That being said, when you look at Justin Martin's career at Xavier, it's in a way, it's kind of sad, I think. And I don't know that he ever would have quite gotten here to this point, because I think he might still have the same struggles this year that he's kind of always had, and that's putting it together consistently for a whole season, not just in these spurts. But I do think Justin Martin is one of those guys that he got banged on early in his career because he wasn't reaching his potential, which he was probably overhyped coming out of high school. It took him a while to even really get on the court consistently or make any type of impact. But I do think we saw at the end of last year that Justin Martin was a very productive player for most of the latter half of the season, and I think he could have improved on that to the point of being one of those guys who really kind of came full circle. He had that extra fifth year. He, you know, started out as a guy that fans really ragged on a lot, but he was continuing to build momentum to get to that point where I think he had a chance this year, if he would have stayed for his fifth year, to get over that hump and really become kind of a fan favorite and become one of the better players who have come through here in the last several years, because he is a talented guy. He is a fun-loving guy that can be very funny and charismatic at times. I just don't think his focus or his head was always in the right place and was always in tune with what needed to be done for the greater good of the team and the program. And ultimately, it's probably why it's a good thing for Xavier that he's going to SMU. But I do think there's sometimes where I look and I just like, man, if he could have just, if something would have happened, that he could have just figured things out a little bit sooner and stayed at X, I do think he would have been a guy that fans really would have looked back on fondly with his career. And now the way it is, it's kind of going to end in a fashion where fans really, he's going to be a footnote to a lot of fans and a guy that they said, you know, kind of good riddance to in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but I could see him having a really productive year next year for an SMU team that might be a top 10 type team.
I could, but I think that would make it sting even worse for fans, for Xavier fans. You know, I think Xavier fans will like him even less if he has a really good year this year.
Well, I mean, and you saw sort of a similar thing with Mark Lyons at Arizona. Well,
and that's exactly who I'm comparing him to, with the sense that fans really kind of just, whatever, once he leaves. And Mark Lyons did a lot of really good things at Xavier.
Right. Now, one side note to this, I guess, from a historical perspective, is that this calls time on that recruiting class, the second recruiting class, actually the first real recruiting class Chris Mack had at Xavier, which was Jay Canty, Jordan Latham, Justin Martin, and Griffin McKenzie. And I think it's fair to say that recruiting class was basically a complete swing and a miss, especially when you consider that Martin wasn't eligible his first year. And I think to a large extent that the sort of whiff that year and then the previous year's transition period where Jeff Robinson was the only kid that came in, I still think that this program is dealing with the fallout from having basically two recruiting classes where, you know, nobody really reached their potential. Nobody stepped up to be a key player except for Justin Martin sort of in the last half season of his career. But I think that's why this year is sort of an interesting one, because it's turning the page from some of the struggles early. And now, you know, you have an entire roster of guys that were recruited by Chris Mack that weren't holdovers from the Sean Miller era. And I think it'll be interesting to see if you see any difference in the way they play, the way they practice, et cetera, now that transition is kind of complete.
I think I think you're onto something. There's something to be said for this is not that, and that recruiting class was Chris Mack, guys, don't get me wrong, but I think there is something to be said for the fact that it's his program now. All of his guys are in place. They kind of got things where they want them, I think. And at this point, here's the one thing about this. At this point, I think you look at this situation now and you say, all of this is on Chris Mack and his staff at this point. They have now had the opportunity. They're past the guys that, you know, they're past the transition periods. They're past this class where they kind of maybe took some of these guys like a Jordan Latham, where they were just, they're kind of holdovers from Miller's recruiting efforts. And they're just trying to hang on to these guys and keep them at Xavier or keep them, make sure they get them committed to Xavier. You can blame that class on Chris Mack and the staff at the time or not. It doesn't really matter, but there's no question about it that's what has set back this program. Or at least through the setbacks that they've had. It's not like they've been terrible, obviously, under Chris Mack. They've made the tournament all the years except for one, but the reasons that they've had the struggles that they have, the reasons that they've been thin, the depth issues that they've had has without a question been a result of that huge swing and a miss in that first 2010 recruiting class with Justin Martin in it. And now, you know, it's kind of come full circle now that he's gone, and it is completely 4 years removed from that class. It is all a new group of guys. It's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward. I will say, wrapping up the Justin Martin to SMU stuff, that the funny part about this, if you're a Xavier fan and what you're probably rooting for at this point, is that he could have a hand in sticking it to UC again and trying to keep them out of the tournament twice next year, now that he's in the same conference as them. The SMU loses Nick Russell, which will kind of be a big loss, but they bring back everyone else. They got a chance to be really good, especially with the addition of Justin. So they could definitely kind of be one of those teams up there competing with UC at the top of the AAC next year.
Sure. So, Rick, I guess the next topic we wanted to hit is to talk real briefly about this summer. We talked a little bit on the last show about the Brazil trip and some of the other issues that were surrounding that. But I think one of the most highly anticipated parts of the summer is the City Year League, formerly the Devereaux League, although I still call it the Devereaux League. And as far as I can tell, so does everyone else.
Live action.
So what can you tell us about when Xavier guys will start popping up in this and when fans should start thinking about setting aside a Saturday or Sunday afternoon to head down to watch the summer league?
Yeah. Now for the veterans of the league, you'll maybe remember this, that this is the first weekend coming up. This Saturday and Sunday is the first weekend the league will start. But if you remember from years past, this isn't a great weekend to go. Now, I'm not saying that there's not the possibility of a player or two showing up, but Xavier has their team camp going on. So a lot of those guys are working the clock or running the concessions or whatever that they've got to do to work team camp. So a lot of the guys probably will not be playing this week. And then the freshmen won't be in until the 22nd. So none of them will be playing for a couple of weeks. So if you're kind of trying to plan when you want to go down there, I will be going down next week. I'll be at team camp this week, but next week I will start going down. I'll be there pretty much every week that I can. And I think the freshmen then will be there that third week. And so if you're looking to probably that third week, fourth week is probably the best time to start going to the league, is when you'll catch most of the players. I do have to, just for clarification purposes, technicals on Jalen Reynolds during the summer league do not count toward our over under tally. Just so we're being clear, I wanted to get that out of the way because I fully anticipate. So I don't want there to be any confusion when you guys go to summer league game and want to tweet at me that Jalen has 5 technicals or whatever it is now. They do not count during the summer league. So if he gets 10, that's fine. He's still under.
I do encourage people to head down for a weekend at some point, especially if, and Rick, do you know, have they set the rosters yet? Are they going to put all the freshmen on the same team this year? Or are they going to split them up a little bit?
Well, I mean, no, usually the thing is the freshmen are allowed to play on the same team. They're the only ones. Otherwise you can only have, I think it's 2 or 3 players from your college roster on the same team during summer league. But if they're freshmen, they don't count towards that. So they will likely, that Deer Park roofing team is always the Xavier kind of Xavier flavored team, should have all the freshmen, or at least all the freshmen that are playing, which I anticipate all of them will. And then another Xavier player too. So that Deer Park roofing team this year should be as much of a Xavier team as it's ever been because of all the freshmen that'll be on it.
Okay. So we will have some, probably some interesting takes on the City Gear League as it goes on.
Always one of the best parts of the
summer. A lot of fun. It's actually a really good event. I assume they're having it at Woodward again this year.
Yeah, it's at Woodward. And
the nice big gym.
Former Musketeer Jamal Walker brings a street ball Rucker Park feel to it with the on-court emceeing that he does, which is outstanding. And the other thing is you get to see some really great basketball players come through there. And especially right now, we've got some really good young talent, not just Xavier guys, but guys from the city of Cincinnati or Northern Kentucky area who are playing Division I elsewhere and come back and play in the league during the summer. So it should be a really good year for it.
It's also great because you always have the random guy that plays for like Sinclair or, you know, one of the other D2 or D3 schools around here, who's really trying to get seen. And goes completely nuts.
Putting up 40 every game.
Yeah. That's always a good time, too.
Jordan Crawford from Bowling Green was that. I mean, 5'7 or whatever he is, and he scores like 30 a game in the league. So
it's a lot of fun. And like Rick says, especially when the full rosters are there, you get to see some pretty good basketball. I mean, it's street ball. There's not a whole lot of coaching going on. There are coaches.
Not sure
what they do. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. But Rick, let's move on to the 2015 class. We talked last week that Xavier, because of the size of the incoming class for 2014, they might take one. They might take two. They may even take three for the 2015 class. They probably will be looking for a physical power forward, but they kind of have some flexibility about guys they might take. And over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of guys that appeared on your hot board commit elsewhere. And although none of them have taken those scholarship opportunities from Xavier, it does narrow down the focus of the staff in terms of the guys they may actually be pursuing. So what can you tell us about where things stand with the 2015 recruiting efforts?
Yeah, this 2015 class, and I think part of it, there's no question that part of it is the fact that Xavier has this huge 2014 class come in right behind it. And not only is it big, but it's good. I mean, people know who JP McCure and Trayvon Blewett are. I mean, incoming recruits, you know, or 2015 kids played against them or saw them. They know how good they are. So I do think that's kind of made it tough. I mean, Xavier doesn't need wings. So it's not, you know, a lot of guys are kind of looking that, even if they're in that like combo forward range, or a guy like Kyle Aaron specifically, who Xavier was recruiting, just committed to Michigan State. Now, granted, he probably would have committed to Michigan State anyway, because it's Michigan State and they offered him. I was a little surprised by that. But you know, that's kind of the part of why this class is so interesting. It's unlike any class that I've really covered since I've been doing this. And it continues to evolve. And at this point, Kyle Ahrens and Derek Pardon both committed last week. Kyle Ahrens went to Michigan State, Derek Pardon to Northwestern. The Michigan State's one thing. Derek Pardon going to Northwestern was even more interesting to me, because I didn't think that he was really that far along in the process when I just talked to him a few weeks ago at Hampton. But I do think what that's doing is kind of, you know, those were kind of two of the guys that were on the top of the hot board for Xavier, and not necessarily guys that they felt they had to get, but just two of the guys that they were probably the closest with when it comes to recruiting. Right now, I'd say Kipper Nichols and Raymond Spalding are probably the two top targets in this class that Xavier is in there on, that they have a chance of landing. And it's funny, because when you look at this class, I think a lot of times we're always looking like they have to add this. They have to add shooters in this class. That was the thing the last couple of years. They have to add a center. They have to add a point guard. This year, they don't. In 2015, especially after they added Larry Austin for 14, they really don't have that position of need, that skill set of need. And in a lot of ways, when I look at this 2015 class, outside of some of the elite guys, the top 20 or 30, maybe even 40 guys, it gets really interesting. I mean, when I look at the rankings, it's like, I don't think anyone did a bad job. I don't think Evan and Brian did a bad job of ranking guys. I just look at the rankings and there are some guys in the 50s and 60s that I just go, I don't know if he's good enough. I don't know if he's good enough to play at Xavier. So I think what the staff now kind of has to look at, and I think all staffs have to do this, but especially if you're in Xavier's staff where your needs are way down, You have a lot of flexibility in this class. You don't really have to take anyone if you don't want to. You might only take one guy and save a scholarship back for 16. Is that I think you're looking with some vision, and that's Ray Spalding to a T. He's a guy who has so much upside and so much ability at 6'9" with his length and vertical leaping ability. I mean, he gets straight up off the floor to block shots like unlike any guy I've really seen in the past couple classes, and his feet are so good when it comes to moving laterally. I think he could really defend ball screens the way Xavier wants to. I think he could be a rim protector. I think he's got a lot of ability, but right now it'd be tough for me to even offer him right now from what I've seen. And he plays at Trinity, so I've seen him a decent amount. I saw him play against Newcath a couple times earlier this year, and he's that guy that if you look at and you have some flexibility, you can take a guy who definitely needs to improve and is nowhere near scratching the surface of his ability yet. That's Raymond Spalding, and that's why I think they've made him such a priority. And then the other thing I think they could really look at is bringing in versatility, bringing in guys who can guard multiple positions so you can play them with different lineups. Even if it's like Kipper Nichols is who I'm talking about here. He's a perfect example of this because to me, he's still more of a combo forward. I think the staff looks at him and thinks he can be a three and is skilled enough to do that. I haven't seen that from him yet. And granted, I didn't get to watch him with his high school team where obviously he shows a little bit more of that because he's got Derek Funderburk underneath. But in AAU, he doesn't get the ball near as much. He plays with Luke Kennard and AJ Harris and VJ King and all these top recruits on that King James team. So he's a guy who kind of has to find his own offensive rebounds or get putbacks, get some garbage buckets and play with effort, which I really like. I think he is a decent rebounder. I think he's a tough defender that can guard multiple positions. And I just haven't seen the skill yet from him, but I think this coaching staff has seen that and they think he's a three, but again, he's a guy who's 6'6", 6'7" with long arms and some strength that he could guard a four if you need him to. He might even be able to guard a two with his lateral ability and his length and his ability to defend. So again, I think that's kind of what they're looking at now is what kind of pieces can you add that really give you great depth or could be a star in years to come that may need some time to sit down, like because Raymond Spalding could sit behind guys like McKinday London and Jalen Reynolds for a couple years and then become a star by his junior year. And I know we're in this mode of guys need to contribute right away in today's day and age when it comes to recruiting, but he's definitely a guy that would be interesting to see because you don't need him to contribute right away. And he could be a guy that has so much potential down the road. So I think those are kind of the two guys to look at right now, but even as they go forward and other targets emerge, kind of look for guys like that, that either can guard multiple positions and give them more versatility at any spot, or a guy that has great long-term potential, but maybe isn't quite there yet.
When you talk about those two guys, and we'll wrap up this discussion after this, but it seems to be pretty commonly held that Spalding is holding out for a Louisville offer and Nichols probably would go to Ohio State if they offered. So given that those things are believed to be true, it probably would be fair to say that no commitment is imminent from either one of those guys.
I don't know that holding out for an offer is the right term, but I do think like if Raymond Spalding got a Louisville offer, I do think that's where he'd go. That being said, he's actually visiting there today. He's going to go up and play open gym and visit there today, which we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. So I don't see an offer coming necessarily, though. Now, if something changes, then yeah, it's going to be really tough to land him, I think. And same thing with Kipper in Ohio State. But in both those cases, I don't expect them to get offers. Now, it's possible. So, yeah, you do bring up a good point about, you know, those guys looking at other schools is kind of their top option.
Okay. Well, that wraps up the recruiting. Let's see, you know, it's the slow time of the year when ESPN starts writing articles that nonsensically rank college coaches.
Yeah.
So what was your take on Chris Mack landing at what, 43 in ESPN's super power poll of coaches based on criteria that are quite unclear to everyone?
Yeah, he got ranked 43rd by ESPN in their top 50. My thing was this when I saw, and obviously this stuff is ridiculous, but when I saw it, I didn't necessarily think 43rd was out of line. But then you start looking at some of the names and what is the criteria? That's the thing. I mean, is it best coaches are based on what they've done long term, what their whole resume says they are, or best coaches right now in the game. Because my thing is, you can't have Bob Huggins at number 30 based on coaches right now. I mean, the guy hasn't recruited in I don't know how many years. He struggled mightily with some talent last year. I don't see how Bob Huggins could be 30 now, but if you're going to say Bob Huggins is 30th because of what he's done throughout his career, then okay.
Oh, maybe he'd be higher maybe than 30 should even if be it higher. Was based on.
Sure. Yeah. But then Archie Miller is 26th. He's ahead of Bob. What are we doing here? Like, I can't figure that out in any, and I'm not banging against Archie Miller or Dayton at all. I'm just, the guy, had he not made that NCAA tournament run, would have been on the hot seat in Dayton last year after the year he had. It wasn't exactly a great regular season for Dayton.
Right.
I just don't, you know, Archie Miller right now, I don't think he's a top 30 coach, but if you're going to say, hey, we're going off of guys right now, well then there's no way Bob Huggins is at 30. You know what I mean? What they've done off the last 2 years or whatever, like Archie Miller, then Bob Huggins can't be 30th. It doesn't make sense.
You know, this is one of those things. I saw that pop up and I was like, you know what? I'm going to spend some more time reading about Ghana's midfield instead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, it took me like 3 days to even look at the thing.
So, Rick, we come to the ever popular potpourri section of the podcast. Let's talk. What do you want to talk about? I guess you've got a list of topics, I think.
Well, my first thing is we've talked a lot about Andy Dalton and the Bengals on this podcast, and I know this has been in the media, but I do think this is legitimately interesting, okay? The Colin Kaepernick deal that was just signed, this has been talked about a lot, and a lot of people make a big deal about how much money he's getting. The thing that I've been completely intrigued by is the fact that his agent would sign this contract. I have never seen an agent sign a deal, at least not that I can recall, for a guy like Colin Kaepernick, with where one, there's a clause that you can be cut every year based on performance, and two, there is de-escalators in your contract based on performance for $2 million a year. I mean, as we go forward, his contract could differ by $4 or $5 million depending on what year it is. I mean, it is a really interesting contract to look at, and I just, from that perspective, I look at, okay, Andy Dalton hasn't done what Colin Kaepernick's done in the league so far. He hasn't taken the Bengals to the Super Bowl. If Colin Kaepernick is going to sign this deal, and $16 million for like 2015, I think it is, could end up being $14 million, or could, and then the next year it could go down to even $12 million. I mean, if there's that much of wiggle room based on not taking 80% of the snaps, or failing to lead your team to the Super Bowl, or not being named first or second team All Pro, why couldn't we sign Andy Dalton to a similar contract for $2 million less? I mean, if Andy Dalton is the base is like 12, and he can get 14 with the incentives, or 10 without him, who has a problem with that deal? I mean, you're saving money you're paying a quarterback below market value for quarterbacks, and he still has the incentive to get up to like $16 million. Why couldn't you sign Andy Dalton to a very similar contract?
Well, as far as Kaepernick's contract goes, I mean, I think that it is a guy showing who has a great deal of confidence in himself, apparently, that he'll continue to play at a high level, and that the 49ers will continue to be super successful, and they'll be fighting for the Super Bowl every single year. And I don't really have any reason to disbelieve that, given what they've done over the last couple of years. Dalton, you know, I struggle because I am a Bengals fan, and I know it can be worse, and I've seen it be worse for many, many years. And having a competent quarterback stinks when you need a elite quarterback, but it's a lot better than having an incompetent quarterback, or as was sometimes the case with the Bengals, three incompetent quarterbacks. So I actually, you know, I'm in this weird mode now where I'm starting to trust the Bengals front office in terms of what they do in the draft and in free agency. And so I actually am not bothered how they want to play this. If they want to slow play Andy Dalton and put him in a situation where he's in his walk year, and it, in the hopes that he puts up a huge year, wins the Super Bowl, and then get, I mean, then he wants a Joe Flacco contract, give it to him. You bring a Super Bowl to Cincinnati, you can have the suspension bridge named after you at that point. I don't care. But on the other hand, if he falls on his face, they could get him either at a bargain rate or they could move on. So I'm interested to see what happens. I can't say that I'll be overly bothered one way or the other unless they give him Joe Flacco money, Joe Flacco years, because I think that would just be ludicrous for where he is.
Coley Harvey, who covers the Bengals for ESPN too, had a report up today with quotes from Dalton saying that he liked the Kaepernick deal and saying that, you know, Colin's very confident in his abilities, like you said, and I feel the same way. I'd be okay with a similar deal. Now, obviously, he's saying that to the media, and his agent's going to be saying another thing. But again, I mean, to me, this is the perfect solution to the problem, because we just don't know if Andy Dalton can be that guy, right? Like, we think he's good, but there's no proof. He's shown nothing to tell us that he can be elite or at least be good enough to lead them past the first round of the playoffs. So if AJ McCarron in a year from now is the better option, you can go to him. One, you can cut Dalton from a contract like this, and two, he can lose $2 million from his permanent salary every single year that he doesn't play in 80% of the snaps, or he doesn't win the AFC title game, or he doesn't have cumulative 80% playing time in all postseason games, not including the Super Bowl. I mean, these are big performance incentives that you have to hit to not lose these $2 million. I'm all for that type of deal.
Well, it'll be an ongoing saga this summer, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Rick, my question for you on the Reds is, after another pathetic showing last night, is this team done?
Well, done is interesting, because when I look at this team, I don't know that they have a chance. They might have dug themselves a hole that's too big to get out of. That being said, when you look where everyone else is, it's like, a really good run in July. I don't know. My thing is, there's reasons for optimism with this team, which is surprising to hear come out of my mouth with the way I usually talk about the Reds. But when we previewed this season coming in, my biggest concern for this team was there's nowhere where they're going to be better, really. Like, there were a couple things I said. If Devin Mesoraco could be really good, if Todd Frazier could be better than what we've seen, if Billy Hamilton could be a difference maker and be better than we think he can be at the plate, then maybe this team can do more. The crazy thing is, the reason I have optimism is all those things have happened. Mesoraco is batting .311 with 9 homers. Todd Frazier's .274 with 13 homers. I didn't expect that out of either one of those two guys. Billy Hamilton, honestly, hitting .250 or whatever he's hitting, is not as bad as I expected out of him. His on base percentage is terrible. I wish that could be better, but I don't think you can deny that he's had a major influence on several games this year, and not just with his base running anymore, but even with his, he's turned into a fantastic fielder, and he's only going to get better.
He's actually way better than I thought as a center fielder, given that he had just converted a couple years ago from a shortstop. And I think he's already better than Drew Stubbs ever was as a center fielder.
Absolutely. And his arm has really impressed me. And it makes sense. He was a shortstop coming up that was known for having a good arm, but you don't really think of that after he moves out to center field. But he's really impressed me with some of his instincts. The way this team could have been better, they are. Those are the areas there were to improve in, they've improved. I look at the rest of the team and I wonder what the hell's wrong. But then you start thinking about it. I mean, hell, Jay Bruce, this is a guy who notoriously goes on slumps where he's the worst hitter in baseball, and then we'll go for a whole month where he's literally the best player in baseball. So if there's a team that could make a crazy run, the Reds have the pitching. They have a couple stars in Votto and Bruce who could get insanely hot. And these other guys are giving them the production that they needed coming into the year if they were going to be better.
Well, I'll just say this, and I think you hit the nail right on the head. When I came into this season, I was looking at it, and I was like, well, there are some X factors. There are some things that have to happen. There are some guys that have to play above their baseline level to get this team into a position to make the playoffs. And you named three of them in Frazier, Mesoraco. Actually, I would have said the catchers, plural, but Frazier,
Mesoraco,
Hamilton. And then for me, it was also like, well, what are you going to get from Johnny Cueto? Well, he's the best pitcher in the National League so far this year. Great. What are you going to get from that? You know, when Latos went down, what are you going to get from that fifth starter spot? Well, Alfredo Simon's been great. The problem is that all the things that I thought were things that you could write in pen this year, Jay Bruce being productive, Joey Votto being available and productive, the bullpen being solid, the bench being improved from last year, none of those things have happened at all. So that's the only reason why I understand when people are like, well, you know, there's reason to believe that this team can get back into it. That's the only reason why I'm like, okay, I can still sort of see it, because you've got Latos coming back this weekend, Votto back in the lineup yesterday. Maybe this machine starts to pick up steam. The problem is it's the same crap we heard all year in 2011, which is the season that I think parallels this one very closely. They had injuries early. They didn't really improve the team from 2010 to 2011. They had injuries early. They got off to a slow start. Everybody from Dusty Baker, Walt Jocketty on down said, just be patient. They'll get it. They'll get it. They'll get it. They never got it. They never got hot. They went weeks and weeks without winning back-to-back games. And that's the kind of season that it seems to be developing into this year. It seems like there's always one aspect of the team that's letting them down. Unfortunately, that aspect is the offense. Rick, this is the slash line for the Reds currently as of today. 237 batting average, 300 on base percentage, 370 slugging percentage. That's 670, okay? Last year, the Reds had a player who was 254, 284, 381 for 665 OPS. So within 5 OPS points of this year as a whole. And that guy was Zach Cozart, who everybody wanted to run out of town on a rail last year because he was so bad. So basically, the entire team is hitting like last year's Zach Cozart, which is not a particularly daunting task for opposing team pitchers, especially pitchers like the guys that are in town this week, Josh Beckett, Ryu, and Granke. So I have a hard time seeing this team get back into the race. But by the same token, I'm not one of those that says they need to be sellers at the deadline. I think they have an opportunity at the deadline to reconfigure this team a little bit. I think this team has some problems in terms of the similarities that certain guys have in the lineup. There's too many of these free-swinging, low OBP, low batting average bats in the lineup, and they're all the same. Heisey, Cozart, even Frazier is like that, although he's a lot better this year. Mesoraco's been that way in the past.
Right.
I think there's an opportunity at the deadline this year to move some pieces around the board without selling the farm, you know, without being a defined buyer or seller, but just to make maybe some challenge trades. Maybe you see what the market will bear for Johnny Cueto for a year and a half of Johnny Cueto at this point at a bargain salary.
Well, I think that's the move you have to look at is Johnny Cueto, Aroldis Chapman, and
Brandon Phillips. Yeah. If you can move him,
well, Ryan Ludwig,
will give you a bag of balls.
Problem is, I mean, no one will take Brandon Phillips unless you'll eat a major portion of that contract. I mean, that contract is so bad, and that's, you're trading contracts more than anything. So,
which is why if you were going to trade a Brandon Phillips or a Ryan Ludwig, what you would be looking for is a guy with a similarly bad contract that maybe brings something to the table that you don't have.
Right.
So for example, I mean, the question was asked, I was talking to somebody the other day. I was like, man, the biggest mistake they made was re-signing Ryan Ludwig after 2012. And he's like, yep. Well, what would you have done? And I said, well, you know, you're allowed to platoon, and a platoon of, say, Rajai Davis and Seth Smith, who were available that year for, I think, combined $5 million. Smith went to San Diego. Obviously, Rajai Davis went to Toronto. That's a group that would have given you 100 OPS points plus on Ludwig last year. I think there's room for flexibility. The Reds were very successful with a left field platoon in 2010. So, I mean, maybe there's a way that you can make Chris Heisey, by only having him hit left-handers, a productive baseball player. I just wish they'd be a little bit more creative. The patience, they've shown an enormous amount of patience with the core players on this team over the last 5 years, and they haven't delivered.
Yeah,
at the end of the day.
Well, and that's a great point, because I remember being in a similar situation like 2 years ago and talking about some of these guys where it's like, well, look, they haven't gotten a chance yet. And we're talking about guys like Heisey and Frazier and Cozart and those. we're now three full seasons later, basically, that we're talking about these guys. And it's still like they're being patient still with these guys. At this point, we know who all these guys are. And I'll say that, like, Frazier surprised me a little bit in the fact that he improved from last year to this year. If he continues that, then that's a very nice piece. But like you said, there's too many similar guys on the roster. You got to get some of these other guys who approach at bats the same exact way, but don't produce in the same way, out of here. And Ludwig is the one that drives me nuts. So I'm completely with you. I wish they never would have brought him back.
The other thing about it is that baseball has changed over the last 5 or 6
pitching
years.
Pitching owns
everything, and the number of good starting pitchers has increased, and it's becoming harder and harder to build rallies the way that you would in the mid 2000s when pitching was worse, which just guys that would sit there, be very patient, run up pitch counts, draw walks, because everybody could hit the ball out of the ballpark. Yeah, now that's not really the case. And I think you're going to see more guys like a D Gordon, who's a high batting average, big time speed type player, all of a sudden has become very valuable to LA. And a guy like Angel Pagan for San Francisco, who's another guy who's a excellent contact, high batting average, good speed guy, is extremely valuable. I look at that San Francisco team and it seems like they've got a really nice mix of high average guys like Sandoval and Pagan and guys that can hit the ball out of the ballpark for you, like a Michael Morse or a Buster Posey. So that's a team that's really well constructed, and it's not a surprise to me that they're doing as well as they are.
Well, and here's the thing on that note. The Reds are set up to be a great small ball team and a team that can do that. I mean, you've got Joey Votto long term, who's a guy who gets on base, is not necessarily someone who's going to hit the ball out of the ballpark a ton, but he can certainly drive in runs if you guys have guys on base. And you've got Jay Bruce, who is absolutely that free swinging home run hitter in the middle of the lineup that can do that for you if he ever gets back to form. Then you've got Billy Hamilton, who is, I mean, the most disruptive base runner in the game. So I would love to see this team get someone like in that two hole that actually gets on base at a reasonable clip and start playing a little more small ball. I think you're absolutely right about the way the game's changing. It's starting to look more like high school or college baseball. And I think you're going to see teams bunting more, sacrificing guys over more, and trying to manufacture and play for one or two runs earlier in the game a little bit more than we've seen the last decade or so with all the home runs.
And, you know, I have always voiced my displeasure at the Reds bunting as much as they do, but part of the reason why I'm angry at them for doing that is because they're so bad at bunting. If you're good at bunting, it can be a weapon. If you're good at hit and run, it can be a weapon. If you're good at stealing bases, if you're good at going first to third, those things can be weapons, but they don't seem to be things that this organization does well from its lowest levels up to the major leagues. So I don't know. I would say that my confidence that this team will get to the, you know, I thought probably going into the season it was like a 45-55 thing, 45% making the playoffs. I think probably now it's maybe one chance in five. I just don't think that I just do not see this team getting on a roll the way they did in 2012 or the way they did in 2010 and going on one of those, you know, 20-6 runs or something like that and getting themselves back into the race. I just don't think it's going to happen. And it's a shame because I don't think Milwaukee's that good. And St. Louis is struggling. They're having a rare down year. And, you know, the division ought to be there to win. But it, unfortunately for the Reds, you know, they've been hit with this injury crisis early in the season and it's dug them a little bit of a hole.
The only thing I agree, I have very little confidence that this team could make a run and get back in it. But I do think that this team could play pretty good baseball the rest of the way and look more like the team we thought they were going to be before the year started for the second half. And I think that's kind of at this point what I'm expecting or at least hoping to see in the second half of the season is that they just read some of these guys return to looking like baseball. I mean, Jay Bruce, you know, like at some point you got to imagine he's going to come out of the slump because he's done this before. I mean, he's been really bad for a prolonged stretch and then he breaks out of it and goes nuts. So hopefully they get closer to being back to that. The guys that we thought were sure things coming into the year, hopefully they get closer to being sure things again. And these other younger guys keep playing well. We'll see.
One last thing, Rick, I'll just ask you what your reaction was, because I know you don't follow it. But what was your reaction when you found out that Landon Donovan was left off the World Cup roster?
Good. It sounds like the USA wants to win. To me, because that's the type of move you make if you know that you've got better talent, if you know that you're building for the future, if you know that you're trying to do the right things to win, even though it's going to go against what everybody wants you to do and public opinion. So I was completely for it, even though obviously it's not a huge thing that I follow. I'm not really invested into whether or not USA wins. I'd love to see it. I know there's a lot more hardcore soccer fans out there that have opinions are differing opinions from mine that think he would have really helped this team. But just from looking at an overall sports perspective, I look at that decision as one that somebody made because they wanted to win more than they cared about being nostalgic for fans.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of, and you know, Jurgen Klinsmann coming in as the coach, he wants to put his own stamp on it. One thing I found interesting, which I didn't know, is that Klinsmann isn't just the coach of the national team, but he's also the technical director of USA Soccer at every level. So it's going to be interesting over the next 4, 8, 12 years, even if he's gone by then, to see whether some of the changes that he's making tactically and so forth to the team as it bleeds down to those lower levels and those guys start to bubble up to the national team to see what effect it has. He may have a multi-decade effect on this team, but I will tell people one thing. Do not have high expectations of the United States in this World Cup because the group is devilishly difficult. They are not the United States team as it stands right now is not particularly well set up to deal with the teams in their group, particularly Germany and Portugal. But even Ghana, I mean, I was looking at Ghana today because that's the U.S.'s first game on Monday evening. I'm sorry. And three of their four starting midfielders play for either AC Milan or Juventus, who are the two most historically successful teams in the Italian league. So even though that team is below the U.S. in the FIFA rankings or whatever they're called, all three of these games are going to be very difficult, but I hope people enjoy it because I think it's going to be a great tournament. It's on at relatively convenient times of the day, late afternoon, good for sneaking out of work and having a few beers if you can get away with it. It should be a great tournament. You know, Brazil, they always put on a good show and I'm really looking forward, especially to the later stages of this tournament when you start seeing teams like Spain and Brazil and Argentina and Germany going up against each other because the clash of the style of play and the drama of those games is pretty great. It's pretty unparalleled in sports. And, you know, it's one of my favorite sporting events and it's nice, you know, it comes around every 4 years. So you get a lot of hype to it and it'll make the next 3 or 4 weeks pretty interesting, I think.
Absolutely. Real quick, before we go, who do you got in the NBA Finals? It's 2-1 Spurs right now, obviously, after game 3.
I think the Spurs are going to win.
In how many games?
Okay, I'm gonna go crazy here. They're winning 5.
Whoa!
I actually think that last night The tendency will be for people to think that Miami will come out and completely obliterate them in game 4. But I honestly think that this San Antonio team is kind of unflappable. And yeah, they played out of their minds last night in game 3. But I mean, it honestly wouldn't surprise me to see them put the foot on the throat in Miami in game 4. I think they're going to win the next 2.
I would not be surprised at all if the Spurs win this. My big surprise would be if the series doesn't go 7 games. I think this is definitely a 7 game series. And I mean, I really have no thoughts on who win. I think the Heat win it in 7, but that's about as much of a cop out as you can get by saying you don't know what's going on. And the only other thing about this series that I look at is a lot of people still have this opinion of the Spurs that they're the old team trying to string it together. But to me, Miami is that team. Like they rely on a lot more guys who like a Dwayne Wade who just aren't always there physically and they don't have anything behind them. Their point guard play is terrible and they don't have depth there. Whereas the Spurs, yeah, they rely on a couple of old guys in Manu, Parker, and Timmy. but they've really been given boost by guys like Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, Patty Mills, guys off their bench who are young guys with plenty of energy, and they have great depth. So I don't think people looking at this as the Spurs are going to tire out, I think are lost. I think the Heat will tire out before the Spurs do. I think the fatigue plays a bigger role to the Heat than it does the Spurs, because the Spurs have done a fantastic job, as they always do, of kind of retooling this and building some players the last couple of years behind all these guys. Patty Mills is about the most perfect example of that you can find, to that these guys are prime time contributors now. They are ready to make big plays in the NBA Finals.
Yeah, the second unit with Mills and Tiago Splitter was great last night. I mean, there were guys that you don't usually see making that big of an impact, because Tony Parker didn't score until the end of the first half, a first half where they scored 71 points or something like that.
It's insane.
So, I mean, they're playing team basketball at just an unbelievable level. Pop just does such a great job of keeping his guys fresh, of getting different guys looks during the regular season. He probably plays that better than any coach I can ever remember in terms of the way he manages minutes for guys, the way, as you say, he integrates his young players in around the stars. I mean, and I'm just so impressed with the way San Antonio has played throughout these playoffs. You know, after they went seven games with Dallas, I think people said, oh, they're definitely over the hill now. And then they completely obliterated Portland and saw off a really good challenge from OKC. I just think this Spurs team is the best team in basketball right now, and I think they will beat the Heat. And I think there is something to the fact that this is Miami's third straight year in the finals. You know, they also had an Olympics during that period of time, which I think all three guys played in. A lot of miles on that big three for Miami over the last few years. I don't think that Spolstra has been able to manage their fatigue the same way that Popovich has.
Well, yeah, and because he doesn't have anything behind him is the biggest problem. That roster is so bad. I mean, really, that team is just not good without LeBron. But he is so good, I still think ultimately the Heat win. Because there are times when he gets going, like he did in the third quarter of game two, where there is just nothing that anybody in the world can do. Nothing. And that's why I'll go with the Heat in seven. But yeah, that to me, the big thing is that I fully expect this series to go seven games.
Fair enough.
All right. Well,
we have to see if Pop turns the air conditioning off in San Antonio for game seven.
That's right. All right. Well, that does it for the 52-2 Holloway edition of the Dana and Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.